Planta. I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. George and Ingeborg Woodcock were fascinating people. He was a noted writer, essayist, and poet, much published published throughout his career as an academic. He was awarded the Governor General's Award for the Crystal Spirit in 1966. He was also an anarchist. She was a Buddhist and indispensable to his life and career. Alan Twigg does a fine job in a new book, Tibetans in Exile, The Dalai Lama and the Woodcocks Recovering, I love that word, their story, how they met the Dalai Lama in 1961 and how they helped found the Tibetan Refuge Aid Society and Canada India Village Aid, both of which are still very active today. The Woodcocks had been traveling in northern India and saw firsthand the appalling conditions of Tibetan refugees. Alan Twigg joins me now to tell us about the Woodcocks and this part of their life that's actually quite fascinating. He knew them in their later years, and the portrait of them is utterly charming. Alan Twigg is a prolific writer himself, having written a biography of Bill Van Der Zandt as well as a soccer memoir. His last book, which he was last on with, was called Full Time. He's written many historical books as well as other memoirs on his travels and his health. He is also the publisher of the absolutely necessary BC Book World, which we will talk about as it's in a bit of trouble. Tibetans in Exile is published by Ronsdale Press. His website is alantwigg.com. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Alan Twigg. Good morning, Mr. Twigg.
Joe, that's a pretty good summary. Now I don't have to say anything.
We don't have to talk about the book anymore. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure.
So when the Dalai Lama visited Vancouver, I guess it was in September, right?
Yep.
It was his fifth visit. There's a center for him here. He has an affinity for Vancouver, and we can trace that back to the Woodcocks, I guess, right?
That's correct, because after the Woodcocks saw him in 61, unlike a lot of people who saw him at the time and said, hey, we'll go away and help, they actually did. And so the Woodcocks were responsible for bringing the first Tibetan refugees from northern India to Canada in the 60s. So a community of, at first they weren't allowed to live in British Columbia for bizarre immigration reasons, but anyway, eventually there is a small community of Tibetans has grown up in British Columbia, including one of the Dalai Lama's associate translators who lives in Victoria. So he was the first person who brought the Dalai Lama here, but before he was famous even. Mm-hmm. So and now there's a peace center which is developed out of British Columbia as well for the Dalai Lama.
So when they meet him in 1961, what did that involve? Did they hang out or what?
Well, it was in the book Tibetans in Exile. There's an excerpt from one of George Woodcock's 150 books that tells the story of how they met semi by accident, and there was a confluence of various events. But Ingeborg had always been very interested in Tibetan culture. She was German born. And she learned a little bit of the language when she was living in Seattle briefly, just after they came here after the war. And so it was her fascination with Tibetans that actually took them to India. And when they, by chance, met someone who then introduced them, et cetera, they went off their travel routine to visit the Dalai Lama. And they quickly realized that the children were basically in dire need of support, and they themselves were childless, and so they sort of adopted the Tibetan children en masse. And that time, the Dalai Lama was, of course, a very young man and really didn't speak English very well. And one thinks, oh, the Dalai Lama is a highly venerable person, etc., but he was probably, and later there's an interesting anecdote to prove this, probably quite intimidated by the Woodcocks and their worldly wise ways at the time. So they basically took a paternalistic interest in him.
There's a scene at the end of the book, and we're skipping here, but where they meet in Vancouver. I guess this was in the 90s.
Right.
And can you describe that? They were at the Hotel Vancouver, I guess?
Yes, there was a... when he stays here, you know, he's in a hotel room. There's a retinue around, people around him, and he has to be worried about security because the Chinese government is continually harassing him in various ways. But as they left their meeting, or their private meeting with him in Vancouver, they walked down a long hallway, and there were various people who witnessed this. And after, I guess, they talked for 45 minutes or something, the Dalai Lama came out into the hallway and watch them leave. They didn't realize as they were walking down this long corridor that he had come out to watch them go, and he stood there in the hallway just watching them for about 2 minutes as they went away, and they never knew that he was watching them. But it was a way, people who saw this realized that the Dalai Lama realized that he would probably never see them again, and that there, as their friendship with him was very significant, because they not only lent a helping hand, but they did it so continuously. Mm-hmm. And that's what's extraordinary about the two societies that they started up. They're still existing. And so they've helped millions of people through these two societies. It's one thing to go and do something and then have a great idea and you know, do a good deed. But the consistency of their friendship and the longevity of these two societies, after both George and Ingeborg are dead, they still continue on. And that's the power of their personalities.
Well, was their involvement in these organizations, was this well known?
No, because they were Buddhist, especially Ingeborg, who was a Buddhist in many, many ways, but she was also a very strong-minded and intimidating person. She abhorred vanity of any kind. In fact, she it was very difficult to get a picture of George because Ingeborg ruled the roost, and that she looked down upon any vanity whatsoever. And so there's very few pictures of her that exist. And so anything they did was unpublicized. And to this day, very few people know that after the Woodcocks died, $2 million from their estate, largely from the sale of an old house, but they gave away $2 million to the Writers' Trust of Toronto to help writers in financial distress. And so but they never would talk about things like that. That was against their creed to be self-glorifying in any way. So these two societies sort of have existed under the radar.
You mentioned the house. That's the house on McCleary Street?
Correct.
Do you live close to that?
Quite nearby, yeah.
Yeah. You spent some time there, did you?
Yes, I got to know them later in their lives, and I was not an intimate of their life in the way that many people were. I'm younger than them, but in some ways I suppose I was a little bit of an adopted. They adopted all these children all the world to help, and they adopted me in an interesting kind of paternalistic way. They didn't have any sons, I guess, and when before George died, I was the beneficiary of some of their kindness. He gave me his signed first edition of George Orwell's Animal Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he was very close friends with George Orwell when he was in England. And so, you know, they always knew what they were doing, and I guess it's some kind of karmic payback, I suppose, that I felt obliged I should record something about their private lives, because so little is known.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they were so extraordinary because they wanted to keep their private lives private. And so I think the world does need to know who they were. And this book, Tibetans in Exile, enabled me to just put forth some smidgens of who they were. There's an interesting quote from somebody who was his secretary. George and Ingeborg were obviously inseparable. And the person said, you know, when one of them breathes in, the other one breathes out. So they were a remarkable couple.
And this house at on McCleary Street, someone owns that now, I guess, right? Someone else?
Yeah, that was basically the estate. It's an old workers. It wasn't a fancy house whatsoever,
yeah.
Because they acquired the property in the late 50s, the Vancouver housing market being what it is. So
yeah.
They lived very, very frugally. I mean, they didn't have any appliances. They were very, very frugal. But the property, by the time you own it in Vancouver for 40 years or something, it ends up being worth a lot of money.
They gave you a Toyota Tercel?
Yeah, Ingeborg's old car. George Woodcock didn't do lots. He'd never voted, or he voted once, and he never drove a car. So Ingeborg was the driver, and they abhorred sort of technology. And so when they went to buy a car, they bought a car with the least number of moving parts. Which is actually quite sane when you think about it, because there's less things to go wrong.
Right.
And so they bought this really simple little Tercel Toyota, which when they died, or it was given to me in the will, and I still drive it because, of course, it hasn't broken down.
Yeah.
So they were very practical people and lived. They did spend money on travel for his research and his books, but they knew what poverty was about when they were homesteading in Souk on Vancouver Island when they first came to British Columbia. They didn't have a bean. And so they were not rich in any material way, but they were rich in all sorts of other ways.
You dedicate the book to Ingeborg, to Ingeborg who knocked. What does that mean?
Well, okay, there's a story that, see, when they went to India to research a book, George Woodcock, because he was a part of the literary crowd in England in the 30s and 20s and 40s as well, friends with Orwell, etc. When he was at, they used to do radio broadcasts with George Orwell at the BBC. And they would meet writers from India as part of these broadcasts. So he had literary connections in India from his days in England. So somebody arranged for him to do some interviews at the All India radio station in New Delhi. And at that radio station, Ingeborg was with him, and she saw a door, which on the door it said something like All Tibet Free Radio. In other words, the sort of BBC in India had an adjunct office for some broadcasting to do with the exiled Tibetans in India. So it was Ingeborg who, of course, that was her personality. There was no door that she couldn't get through if she didn't want to get through it. And so she, being interested in anything to do with Tibet, knocked on the door. Behind that door was a man named Lalumpa, who was the first Tibetan brought to Canada by the Woodcocks. But he was an intellectual dissident who had basically been doing cultural programming in India for Tibetans to preserve the culture. And it was through that connection of that chance meeting they were introduced to other people who then introduced them to the Dalai Lama's niece, who said, you know, you must come and see Uncle. And the niece, they didn't know who Uncle was, and it turned out Uncle was the Dalai Lama. So that knock on the door opened the door to 40, 50 years of fundraising for Tibetans and other people in the Himalayas as well.
Now, she was a Buddhist, and he an anarchist. Are those two not supposed to mix?
I would think that they found out there were lots of things to mix between the two. And George was a philosophical anarchist, and he wrote probably the most important text, modern text, on anarchism, which is in 20, 30 languages throughout the world. And so anarchism, as I hope a lot of your listeners know, is not about throwing bombs and disrupting society.
Right.
It's a school of thought that is always distrustful of government and is brings to bear the power of individuals working together on a small scale and retaining independence. So his anarchism was an enlightened form of Buddhism, if you will. There's no hierarchy in their meetings of these societies. There was nobody who they did have on paper a president and that kind of thing like that. But all decisions would be made by consensus, and so they tended to have a very worldly view of affairs, and so I don't know. I can't really explain why the anarchism and the Buddhism work together. But if you read the book, you'll see things in their personalities that sort of complemented one another.
Yeah, what I enjoyed reading in the book was that they liked listening to Art Bell. Yeah. And they did that all the time, did they?
Yes. Well, no, that was Ingeborg, because Ingeborg was a bit kooky.
Uh-huh.
And you know, was a strange, unusual, intimidating, provocative person who was quite uninhibited in her judgments of others, could be quite severe. So her reputation as a severe presence is what people often talk about. But underneath, there was obviously a very gentle, good person who just couldn't express the gentle side of her character. She was very fond of animals, for instance, took in strays and all that kind of stuff. So her personality really, really interested me because it's been unrecorded. George Woodcock has written some volumes of autobiography, which are not his best books by far, because he was actually quite secretive, and he doesn't tell you much in those books. But George is known, you know, as one of Canada's most prolific men of letters, and there's almost nothing in print anywhere in the world about Ingeborg, and yet they were two equally powerful characters. So it seemed important to at least acknowledge her existence. This is not an in-depth biographical portrait of Ingeborg Woodcock at all, but it allows some people to share their personal reminiscences of what she was like, and you see the complexity of the person through people telling stories about her.
You don't see much of her in the Fetherling biography, right?
No, the George Fetherling's admirable biography of George Woodcock really looks at George Woodcock's literary career and his role as a thinker, as a public thinker, public intellectual, but it does not delve into the private side of his life a great deal, largely because Ingeborg absolutely refused to have anything to do with it.
Did she like Fetherling?
I think that anybody who was coming into George's territory and possibly taking a few pieces of him away would not be welcome in Ingeborg's world, because it, as in some respects, George was her baby.
Yeah.
And so she was very possessive of George and very protective of him. So I think anybody who was approaching that house attempting to write a biography of her husband would be unwelcome. So it's unfair to say that she didn't like George Fetherling, which would be true.
Yeah.
But that had more to do with Ingeborg than George Fetherling.
She liked you, though, right?
She did.
Yeah.
But that was different. I guess I liked listening to her, and every time I would go and visit her later on in life, as a journalist, I think, God, you know, I should really write down all these incredible things she told me. But it would have been a little bit like a trespass, and I never did. I thought, you know, I really should be writing this stuff down. So, you know, 5-10 years go by, she dies, and then you realize, yeah, I better do something. And I knew enough of the people who knew her that I knew I could get them to contribute their stories. So it's not my view of them, it's me just recording other people's view of them.
Let's talk about BC Book World here, because as you know, I'm a big fan of it. I'd seen some stuff on Facebook about, I guess this all came about a few weeks ago with regards to the cuts in funding by the provincial government.
Well, this is my little story is part of a much bigger story, probably largely because of the Olympics, but also because of the recession. The government of British Columbia overestimated its revenues, and now they're having to make drastic cutbacks all over the province to get themselves out of a jam. And so there's all sorts of things, environmental groups, community groups, all sorts of people are having their monies either rescinded or just partially taken away. Anyway, so we got a phone call. The BC Book was supported by a nonprofit society for 22 years. We got a phone call with 3 weeks' notice saying that, you know, we would now no longer get any funding from the provincial government. And at the time, you think, this is shocking. Oh, this is, how can they do this? There's no paper trail. It's just ridiculous. But it's part of a much larger series of cutbacks around the province to nonprofit organizations, et cetera. So, we had all of our funding taken away with no notice. But, you know, for me, it's okay because I have the skills to fight back. I produce a newspaper, which is a luxury most people don't have. And I have 100,000 readers, so I do have resources, and I realize I can get through this. But what bothers me much more is there's so many other small groups that probably can't. And so there's interesting things happening in British Columbia right now.
So just about the paper, because for a lot of us, it's an indispensable part of what, you know, what of our lives and our reading and the sort. Will the paper survive?
Yes, the paper is definitely going to survive. It's the paper is unstoppable. And in fact, I just published a new issue the other day. So even without there being a newspaper out to tell people, I received over 100 letters within 3 weeks from people. Say, and the government has been bombarded with people writing letters. It's going to continue. People are angry at the stupidity of this publication, which allows people to find out the books about their own society, et cetera, through 900 outlets around the province, which is the main cog in the infrastructure that supports writing or publishing in BC. And you have a premier who says that he wants British Columbia to be the most literate place in North America. How can you possibly countenance, you know, rescinding support for that? So many people are very angry about it, and that's fine, and I will survive because people are now being forced to value something which they in some ways took for granted. So there are some weird kind of silver linings to this crisis. It's a temporary challenge, and I'll get through it, and I'll get over it, and I'll figure out how to survive. So it's BC Book World will be around for another 22 years because it has to be. But what I find on a personal level is interesting. It's forced me to become politicized, and I resent that because it's enough work just to put out the paper. There's only two of us who do it for 22 years. So you have this sort of double workload now. You're having to deal with what's happening in the society around you. And I think that many people, I think coffee shops around British Columbia are now being forced into these conversations about what the heck is going on here. So I think there's a really interesting kind of grassroots rebellion to these small cuts to community groups.
So what can people do, people who find BC Book World important to
them? What I'm suggesting people can do is take a supporter. I'm not here. I'd rather talk about the Woodcocks than the paper, because I don't need anybody's help to get through this. But if people want to become sort of supporter subscribers, where you can send $25 and then we'll send you the newspaper for the year, you know, by Canada Post. So we're basically doing what the government wants us to do, is, you know, become self-supporting. But they don't realize that any government subsidies we've received actually just go into subsidizing the low cost of advertising for the publishers, which allows all these small publishers to tell the public what books exist. And it's an educational newspaper. It's not really a conventional review periodical. The main thing we want to do is provide as much information as possible about as many BC books as possible to as many people as possible. And it's about educating the public about the books that exist about them. And so, you know, yes, you can write a letter to your MLA. You know, yes, you can take out a subscription. But, you know, my little hurdle here is relatively minor compared to, I think, many groups which don't have the wherewithal to educate their constituents the way I can. And so I'm not worried about BC Book World in the long run. I'm actually worried about the province.
Mm-hmm. Now, back to the book. Ingeborg, after George died, living without him, that was hard for her?
Very much so, because, you know, she was, you know, she her role in life was to facilitate him to write these books. And she was also, you know, the main organizational force behind these charities, but the charities then themselves became rather self-supporting, so it was very difficult for her to live by herself without George, because she was the meaning of his life, which I think is very classic for many couples I suppose couples without children especially. So, yeah, she had a very, very difficult time.
And then the end for her was that she spent it in a home, right?
Yeah, she Well, she resisted going into it. She was just a resistor, period. But it was very difficult for the people close to her to manage her affairs at the very end. And so I suppose the last days of many elder citizens are not pleasant. And she got into a lot of hot water at the end because she was not an easy person to take care of. And she did not. She was also not a. She was not a person who accepted help.
And she smoked to the end, right?
Oh yeah, she smoked and drank to the end. And you know, they were odd ducks. I mean, they would really. You couldn't phone their place before noon because they would. George would usually stay up till right to about 4 a.m. And you mentioned listening to Art Bell. Well, while George was working on a book, always working on 2 or 3 books, but. Working, you know, late at night, Ingeborg would be up as well listening to these radio broadcasts. So they would kind of, their day would start around 11 a.m. So they that alone made them odd ducks. And and George's anarchism meant that they got involved in various social issues and always dynamic and always traipsing around the world. So they did not lead a normal life.
I have to admit, Alan, when the people at Ronsdale sent the book, I didn't think that it was something that I would want to read. But because I'm such a fan of BC Book World and we've had your brother John on for years, I thought we'd still have you on for it. Then I picked up the book and read it. Man, it's just a great story about great people.
Well, it's kind of interesting because the challenge was, you know, how can you write an engaging book about do-gooders who, you know, societies that help people and, you know, so it was interesting kind of constructing this to make it into a story. And the climax of the book really is that you get to know the private lives of these two extraordinary people.
Yeah.
And then you get to see how also... the world is full of inspiring people doing great things all the time, and that, thank God, we have so many people who are constructive, who, you know, do unpublicized good work, and it's inspiring when you stop and think about, well, all these kids nowadays with their little mini charitable public funding foreign aid projects via the internet. I mean, they're just doing what the Woodcocks did 40, 50 years ago. Taking the power into your own hands and helping people directly without government intervention. The anarchist model that the Woodcocks devised is been replicated on the internet by young people, you know, raising funds to help one village somewhere to buy, you know, a new generator. That's the sort of thing that's happening on the internet all the time now. People are empowering themselves to help other human beings on the other side of the planet, and now it's taken as normal. But the Woodcocks, you know, were doing that sort of thing by the force of their personalities in this from the 60s onwards, and so they are inspiring. And the book is just shows you can change the world.
And you've done a great service writing. Continued good luck with it, Alan.
Oh, lovely to talk to you again, Joe, and I'm really glad you do. You know, so it's such a pleasure to be able to do an interview that goes on for more than 3 minutes.
You're very welcome.
Okay.
The book is called Tibetans in Exile, The Dalai Lama and the Woodcocks. It's published by Ronsdale Press. AlanTwig.com is his website. BCBookWorld.com is the website for the paper. Do contribute to that. Alan Twig on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plano.